from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, a Texas jury approves medical experimentation on a 7-year-old, public hearings on unalienable rights, and a House member demands an apology from a high-ranking official for not being politically correct. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. In July, the State Department, under the direction of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, created the Commission on Unalienable Rights, and on Wednesday, the commission held their first public hearing. Joining Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to discuss the hearing is the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo.
Secretary, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's great to be with you again. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Absolutely. I want to thank you for having the courage to move forward with something I think is foundational to our foreign policy, but not everybody thinks so. You've gotten a lot of pushback on the creation of this commission.
Yeah, Tony, we have, and it's unfortunate. This is a commission that has a set of commissioners from a broad political perspective, different faith traditions, all aimed at something that I think every American can agree to, which is our conception that our founders put in place of the protection of human life and dignity is central to America's well-being and our exceptionalism as a nation, and indeed our beacon for the entire world. And what we're hoping to do is to take this idea of rights, which sometimes becomes confusing or turns into simply personal or political preferences, and reground it in the history and tradition of the United States, so that we are moored to something more than someone's fancy of the moment, and we come to understand that these incredibly cherished fundamental rights are at the very core of the American experience.
I mean, as I see this, Mr. Secretary, I mean, there are over a certain period of time, you may need to recalibrate just to make sure that your compass points to true north. And I think what you're doing is you're pointing back to these founding documents and tying our foreign policy to a foundation that goes back to the very beginning. And, you know, there have been times in our nation's history where we've deviated from that. And it's important that we come back.
Tony, that's absolutely the case. It's the among the purposes of this commission. We have deviated from time to time. We've become confused, not just here in the United States, but around the world. You see something as hypocritical as the government of Venezuela being appointed a seat on the UN Human Rights Commission.
Yeah.
I mean, this is untethered to anything left, right, center in America would understand as decent and right and protecting human dignity. If you observe what's going on in Venezuela today, you can see that it's the antithesis of the protection of individual liberty and freedom and the rights that we all know. And so we're trying to cut back to the roots to make sure that everyone is grounded in this tradition. And I will tell you, around the world, people are watching the work that our commission is undertaking. There is a thirst for this work. And I think this will be a document that is prepared, a commission chartered by the United States Department of State, but one that I think citizens all around the world will be able to hold up. When their human rights, when their fundamental rights are being challenged, they'll be able to hold up this document and point to this important work that's been done.
I want to go back to something you just said a moment ago, because you made this point in a speech yesterday at the Heritage Foundation, where you talked about how there has been a perversion of the word right for nefarious means, that people have taken that, in my words, not your words, but used it like silly putty, stretched it and distorted it to use for things that it was never intended to be used for.
Tony, it's true, and this has at least two outcomes that are bad. One is that you'll end up with people asserting rights that we all know are fundamentally at odds with the most fundamental ideas that come out of not just Christianity, but all the Abrahamic faiths.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first problem. The second one is that when other rights are added into the mix, when you use the word right for something that is a mere preference, then there's focus and attention and energy applied to preserving and protecting that thing called a right, and that comes almost necessarily at the expense of the fundamental rights If you're enforcing and protecting everything all the time,
right,
you lose sight of the focus and the things which are truly central to human dignity, the capacity for individuals to express their own conscience, and the things that you and I, and I think nearly every American has come to understand as those rights which are most fundamental, just simply as a result of our humanness.
So, I mean, in essence, what you do is you dilute your strength, your power, your ability to focus on those essential rights, and as a result, everyone suffers.
That's it. You have it precisely right.
Let me talk for a moment in terms of the outcome. And you made reference, you want a document that people can hold up, not just here in the United States, but around the world, and point to this document of unalienable rights. What's the time frame, and what is the anticipated outcome?
So the process started with our first public meeting today, although the commissioners have been reading and preparing for today in the anticipation of what we would kick off. There'll be a handful of other meetings. They're public. We welcome everyone to join us for these meetings, and there'll be an opportunity for the public to speak, many of them as well. So there'll be a transparent, open process where I think the world will see how thoughtful we consider the work that we do. We're hoping to wrap up by the middle of next year. And when we do that, we'll have a document. We will have this tangible expression of what it is the Commission concludes are indeed these fundamental human rights and why they matter so much to America. And I think then others in the world will see it benefits them as well. But we will also then go out and share this vision with people all across America and all across the world so they can come to understand that this exceptional nation here in the United States is not embarrassed by the fact that we cherish those fundamental rights which our Creator has provided for us.
Mr. Secretary, one of those fundamental human rights is one that this administration and you, as Secretary of State, have been very diligent to both protect and promote, and that is the issue of religious freedom. It has become a top foreign policy initiative of this administration, led by the President, the Vice President, and you as Secretary of State. I was watching you last week when you were with the Vice President in Turkey negotiating the ceasefire, and was encouraged by both your comments and by the Vice President's comments when it pertained to religious freedom and religious minorities in northeast Syria. And I want to get your sense of that. What was taking root there in northeast Syria was unique in the Middle East, true religious freedom, the ability to not just worship as you choose, but to choose your faith and to live it out. What are the prospects for that continuing to prosper in that region of the world?
Tony, I'm glad you asked about this. This is the problem set in northeast Syria is, as you know, incredibly complicated. But one of the things that the President had directed and then Vice President and I worked diligently on as part of our effort to convince the Turkish leadership to stop their incursion into northeast Syria. One of the things we were very focused on, if you read the joint statement, you'll see that it was agreed to, was to ensure that there was, in fact, the very protections that you described. And that's good. That is important. It's a good start. We need to make sure that we have the words and the commitments on paper. But as you know, Tony, something that this administration has worked very hard on is the rights, not just in northeast Syria, but throughout the Middle East and in Iraq in the north, where Yazidis and Christians are mm-hmm. incredibly challenged in the cradle where Christianity has a long and deep history. It's under threat. It's under attack. We've appropriated a great deal of money. The State Department works tirelessly on behalf of protecting the rights of religious minorities in Syria and Iraq and throughout the Middle East. There's a lot of work left to be done. We've made some progress, but there remain many challenges.
Well, it's certainly one that will not only be a focus of foreign policy, but I hope for Americans a source of prayer, because I think those folks there are looking to America for encouragement and for strength. And it was a source of hope to see that light of freedom burning there in the Middle East. And Mr. Secretary, I know your time's short. You got to go. But I do want to just again thank you. And as I talked to the president a week before last, just appreciate the continued focus on religious freedom and its fundamental and essential part that it plays in both our domestic and foreign policy.
Tony, thank you. We're committed to it. It's something that we work on each and every day, and something that we know advances America's values all around the world and makes makes lives all around the world just a little bit better each and every day.
All right. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us.
Tony, thank you, sir.
You can find out more about the Commission on Unalienable Rights when you visit tonyperkins.com. While you're there, you can also find out more about FRC's efforts to promote religious freedom abroad, as well as here at home. You can find those details at our website. Again, that's tonyperkins.com.
Where can you get news these days that doesn't make you suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. To claim this offer, visit washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Earlier this week, a jury in Texas returned a verdict that would prevent Jeffrey Younger from intervening in the gender transition of his 7-year-old son, James, which his estranged wife wants to move forward with. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to talk about the case is FRC's Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, Peter Sprigg.
Peter, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony.
First, I want to start with the point. This is a 7-year-old boy.
Yes.
How do you determine that a 7-year-old has gender dysphoria?
Well, this is a claim that's being made by the mother. And as in so many, very sad divorce cases and child custody cases that result from divorce, there's very much of a he said, she said aspect to this. But the mother claims that the child identifies as female, that wishes to be called a girl named Luna. But the father says exactly the opposite, that this child, when he is with the father, because up till now they have had joint custody or shared custody, that when he's with the father, he's perfectly happy to identify as a boy and wear boy clothes. The thing that this suggests to me, though, is that the child, this by definition means that the child does not meet the diagnostic criteria for gender dysphoria, because to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria, a child is supposed to be consistent, insistent, and persistent in asserting the gender identity that's different from their biological sex. If they only assert it in one house and not the other, that means they don't meet the criteria for gender dysphoria.
Now, just so we're clear on this, we're not talking about a mother allowing a child to cross-dress or, you know, act as a girl. We're actually talking about beginning a process which is essentially chemically castrating her son.
Yes. This is where this would ultimately lead to. Now, in the hearing they held in this case, I understand there's some dispute, and the father and his attorneys have tried to raise alarm about the prospect that this 7-year-old child could begin the process of puberty-blocking hormones as early as age 8. The mother's attorneys are downplaying that, saying, oh, no, it might not begin until age as late as 11 and a half. But in any case, this has become the standard of care for gender dysphoric children, to put them on puberty-blocking hormones before they enter puberty in order to prevent them from developing the physical characteristics of their biological sex, and then put them on cross-gender hormones eventually, and then when they become adults, have gender reassignment surgery. This is the path that the mother seeks to put him on.
Are there health implications for this, for the child?
Oh, there can be very serious health implications from these puberty-blocking drugs, as well as the later cross-gender hormones, a number of very serious health consequences that can result. In fact, part of the reason why that some people, conservatives who criticize this, are calling it chemical castration is because one of these drugs that is used is actually the same drug that is has been proposed to be used to chemically castrate sex offenders. But it can have effects on a person's heart health and so forth, besides the fact that it renders them permanently infertile if this whole process under
is it reversible?
Well, the argument that the transgender activists make about the puberty blocking hormones is that it is a process that's reversible. The reason these exist for children is because there are some children who have a condition where they go into puberty prematurely, say at age 5 or something. Then they'll be put on these hormones until the normal age for puberty. Then they'll taken off these hormones and they go through normal puberty. But we really don't have scientific evidence of the consequences of using it this way, of preventing puberty. There's no record in the scientific literature of a child being put on puberty blockers at 11 and then taken off them at 18 and going through normal puberty.
So we're experimenting on children.
This is very much a vast scientific experiment, and it's frankly part of a social experiment as well.
But it's not necessary for health.
No, obviously not. This is disrupting the normal physical processes of the child's body.
Now, apparently, and I was reading through this, that the judge is going to rule on some aspects of this case,
right,
which may include that – and this has been requested by the mother and her attorneys – that the father has to affirm the choice of this boy transitioning to a girl and can only have him around people who affirm that choice. That's a request being made.
Right. And, you know, I want to emphasize that up until now, under the joint custody agreement, the father was already under some constraints. He could not sort of force the male gender identity on the child. So at least according to his testimony, what he would do is he would lay out male clothes and female clothes and let the child choose. And he said when the child was in his home, he always chose the male clothes.
Well, I mean, could that not be the influence of a father on a child? I mean, isn't that why children need a mom and a dad? They especially boys. They learn their masculinity from their fathers?
Well, and another thing that sometimes hasn't been mentioned in some of the news stories is this child is actually a twin. He has a twin brother.
Yeah.
And so I wonder about the impact on the twin brother of having his twin brother suddenly become a twin sister. It's a very complicated situation.
But this gets into some other areas of – you know, moms and dads, people who have children. First off, you know, it's what really has always bothered me in family law is how when adults can't get their business straight, the kids suffer.
Exactly.
And you have the courts now interjecting itself into – this is a new frontier. You know, it used to be, you know, how many nights a week they would stay at one place and, you know, who got to keep what toys and, you know, that sort of thing. Now we're actually talking about children, one parent deciding that a child needs to transition to another sex. I mean, this has, as we talked about just a few moments ago, health implications. It has spiritual implications. This has so many implications. I mean, adults need to get their business straight.
Yes. I mean, it reminds me of a book one of our pro-family colleagues wrote a few years ago called Between Two Worlds. And it talks about how when children are being raised by a married couple, it's up to the couple to negotiate the differences between them and raise the children. When there's a divorce, then it becomes up to the child to negotiate the differences between the parents.
Right.
That's something they shouldn't have.
And
to do.
You get the courts in increasingly where you have this propaganda that's being put out about gender being, right, you know, fluid, and you can decide whoever you are and whatever you are. That's making its way into our courts.
Yes,
and you know, it's just tragic when, you know, Christians, you know, end up not being able to work out their differences, and they end up in a court that is hostile to their faith, and you see, you know, children, things like this happening to children.
Yes, and I did want to mention this is unusual. As I did some research here, in Texas is apparently the only state that has jury trials that will allow a jury trial for custody disputes.
I was asking about that this morning because I've never seen that before.
Yeah, it's very – there are some states, I guess, that will have allow jury trials for other aspects of divorce proceedings. Texas is the only state that does that for child custody.
Tragic. A seven-year-old boy. Well, Peter, thanks so much for sticking around. I guess you're off to the races now. So
thank you.
Have fun at the horse show. Peter Sprigg, thanks so much for joining us.
I want to note that on Thursday afternoon, the judge in this case thankfully ruled that the father will still have a say in his son's medical care and the mother will not be able to begin a so-called medical gender transition unilaterally. We encourage you to keep James and his father, Jeffrey, in your prayers.
We live in a time of great political division, and this divisiveness can be incredibly discouraging. It makes it very tempting for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. But Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, including how they engage in politics. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. Visit frc.org/engage to learn more.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. On Tuesday of this week, at a House Financial Services Committee hearing, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson asserted that political correctness will, quote, destroy our nation, end quote. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to talk about his comments is Secretary Ben Carson.
Secretary Carson, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, wonderful to be with you again.
You made a comment. I've got a clip here of your appearance before the committee on Tuesday where Congresswoman Jennifer Wexton of Virginia asked you a question about wanting to apologize for a statement you made. I want to play this clip, and then I want to get you to respond to it.
Secretary Carson, I see I only have about a minute left, so I wanted to give you a chance to apologize for comments you made during a meeting with HUD staff last month where you described transgender women as big, hairy men.
Well, first of all, I didn't describe transgender women that way. I was relating a story that a women's group told me about big, hairy men who are not transgender women, by the way, coming into your facility and having to be accepted because of the rules that were in place.
What was the women's group that told you this story?
It was a group from Alaska.
What was their name?
I don't remember.
Okay, could you get that for us, please? You don't feel the need to apologize for those comments?
No, I think, you know, this whole concept of political correctness, you can say this, you can't say that, you can't repeat what someone said, is total foolishness and it's going to destroy our nation and we need to be more mature than that.
Well, Dr. Carson, I could not have said it better. And I think you have been consistently saying this issue of political correctness is destroying our nation. And you've been criticized for that.
Yes, it's foolishness because, you know, the First Amendment guarantees people freedom of speech. What political correctness does is it makes people afraid to express themselves. So coming in the back door, it actually suppresses the First Amendment. And we need to be very, very wary of anything that takes away our constitutional rights.
Now, Congresswoman Wexton, after the hearing, said, and I'm going to quote from her, this was on Twitter. She said that your response, quote, hateful words translate into discriminatory policies. And Secretary Carson has demonstrated that time and again. I listened to your testimony. I heard what you said. I missed the hateful words. Where were they?
Well, to them, anything that doesn't agree with them is a hateful word. And that's what I mean when I said we need to be more mature than that. You know, that's what I might expect from, you know, a third grade playground. And, you know, if we make everything such a sensitive subject and everybody has to sit down and filter everything that they say and we're listening carefully to their words instead of what their meaning is, what do we become as a society and as a people? It's fearful to really think about it. And we've got to nip it in the bud before it gets to the place where everybody just is silent and they can't say anything because it's going to offend somebody.
Well, I want to go beyond that for a moment. First, I just want to thank you for being refusing to grow silent in the face of this political correctness. But I also want to talk about what you have accomplished at HUD. You know, she wants to talk about discriminatory policies. I want to talk about your policies that have expanded access to people who need housing because you're allowing faith-based organizations to partner with and to be a part of meeting needs in local communities unafraid of having to leave their faith at the door, which is exactly what this was about. I'm familiar with the case in Alaska where this crazy policy from Obama put women who were abused going into these shelters at greater risk because you had men who said they were transgender coming into the shelters.
Exactly. It's absolutely absurd on the face. And all we need to do is come back to being logical. We're not talking about denying anybody their rights. You know, Jesus says we're to love everybody, and he'll do the judging. But as a society and as a government, we do have a right to make sure, or we do have a duty to make sure that everybody's rights are protected. So everybody gets equal rights, but nobody gets extra rights. Your rights don't get to be special so that you can stamp on my rights. And that's what some of these groups are trying to do. They say you have to consider what we do. It doesn't really matter how it impacts someone else. Of course it should matter. And the women in those shelters, many of them are in that shelter because they're trying to escape an abusive situation with a male. And they have some rights also. Now, does it mean that the transgender person shouldn't be taken care of? No, it doesn't mean that. But right. You've got to look for another way to do it that doesn't threaten the rights of others.
I mean, that's the principle that America has been guided by for centuries, equal rights for all, special rights for none. I mean, that's what makes America work. Dr. Carson, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us and thank you for the excellent work you're doing at HUD.
Well, thank you.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.